I'm Lark Miller, and today you will hear my story on San Francisco people.
Hey everybody, welcome to San Francisco People. This is Frank Garza, and I'm excited to introduce you guys today to Lark Miller on the show. He is a personal trainer, and he's the founder of Infinite Fitness, which is in the Bentley Reserve building in downtown San Francisco. And I met Lark through Eric Wiseman, who was my guest back on episode 15. So on today's show, we're eventually going to walk through Lark's journey to becoming a fitness trainer and opening up Infinite Fitness. Lark grew up in a very small town in Massachusetts that had more cows than people. He competed at a high level in cross-country skiing, in mountain biking, and in road cycling as he was growing up. And he also had a stint as a life coach and shared some interesting experiences from that time. Lark got certified as a fitness instructor, and then he started his one-on-one fitness instruction actually by going door-to-door in his neighborhood and inviting his neighbors to work out with him on the streets and on the sidewalk of his neighborhood. So I thought that was really cool. Lark gives us some tips for how we can be more healthy. I feel like most people in San Francisco are already pretty healthy, but how can we take it to the next level? What's some additional things we can do to be healthier? Lark has some tips around that. He lives in the DeBose Triangle, and he shares his favorite spots in the hood there, as well as throughout San Francisco. So let's go talk to Lark.
When I first moved to my hometown, I was 2 years old, and there were 300 permanent residents in the town.
Nice.
And about 600 cows.
So the cows could have taken over.
The cows were taken over. It was a big problem. That's why they called me in.
Okay. Where were you born originally?
I was originally born in Shelburne, Massachusetts.
Okay.
And my parents lived on a farm. There were lots of meadowlarks in the field, which is how I got my name, Lark. My father thought it would be a good idea to name me after a bird.
All right.
For some reason.
I was just about to ask you, I didn't even know what a meadowlark was. What does a meadowlark look like?
It's a pretty little brown bird with a yellow patch on its chest.
Okay.
And the only thing really distinctive about the lark as a bird is that it sings in flight.
Okay. Oh, so cool.
I read that it's the only bird that sings in flight. I don't know if that's actually true or not, though.
Or are you an artist yourself? Do you sing?
No.
Based on that?
You don't want to hear me sing. My girlfriend, she can sing.
Yeah?
We'll listen to her sing all day, but...
Okay. And so you said the name of it was what that you were born in? What was it?
Shelburne?
Shelburne. And then when you were two...
Moved to Heath.
You moved to Heath, and that was a town of just like 300 people,
that's
600
right.
cows.
Yep.
And and then did you live there all the way through high school?
Yep, lived there all the way through high school. We moved away for a short period. My parents built a house, and we lived in a neighboring town for a year while I was in high school, and then moved back to Heath, where my parents still reside.
Oh, so
my father passed
there.
Away, but my mom moved back with my stepfather. Now there's 800 permanent residents.
It's growing.
So it's really blowing up.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, that is small. I consider myself from a small town, but we had 10,000 people. So you're like those towns I drive through on my way to like Tahoe or something like that, where it says like population like 200.
Exactly. Yeah. And it is really, you know, I bring people back there and say, wow, you really live out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. So what was high school like then? I would imagine that, you know, you're trying to like get girlfriends, but you only have like 5 to 10 to choose from that are in your range.
It got really incestuous. I mean, you know, all of my friends and I were basically had all the same boyfriends and girlfriends that we passed around back and forth to each other throughout high school. Yeah, it was a big 8-town region, though, and there were some other towns around there that were a little bit better populated. So by the time I got in high school, there were you know, 800 kids in my high school.
Okay.
Yeah. And half of those were in the middle school, seventh and eighth grade. So the population was growing really fast at that point.
Okay.
It's leveled off a little bit now, but.
All right. And then I think I read you went to college. Is it UMass?
Yeah, I went to Marlborough College for a couple of years in southern Vermont, which was also, you know, very, very tiny little college, 200 students.
Oh, wow. So you wanted to keep it small.
Yeah. Well, my high school girlfriend and I, we collaborated and decided to go there together. We were very much in love. We broke up while we were there. And she moved on and I stayed for another year and then I went to University of Massachusetts. I started to feel very pigeonholed there.
Yeah.
In terms of, it was very expensive and I was doing environmental science and I consider myself an environmentalist to this day, but the science track, I just didn't feel like I really gelled or got along with the students in my program nearly as much as with the students who were doing the, you know, philosophy major or history or English majors.
Right.
So I bounced over to University of Massachusetts and started doing anthropology.
Okay.
And had some amazing professors, had an incredible time, graduated with an anthropology degree and went on to do absolutely nothing with it.
Right. So how many students were at University of Massachusetts then?
50,000.
Okay. So what was that like going from... small town college, and now you're in this like gigantic community of people.
Well, I'll tell you, it was such a breath of fresh air. I felt like I was so free because at Marlborough College, like everybody knew everything about everybody, and everything that everybody did got aired to everybody. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking to students, faculty, staff. There were no secrets in that place. And not that I was a guy who wanted or needed to keep a lot of secrets. After a while, it felt like, you know, people look at you and they think they know who you are. And to walk into a new place where nobody knew me and I was able to kind of reinvent myself was very exciting.
Cool. Yeah. So I read that you played or competed semi-professionally in cross-country skiing, road biking, and mountain biking.
That's true.
And you've told me a little bit about the skiing, but that was mostly downhill skiing you were doing.
Yeah, that was all during high school. And then when I went to college, I started becoming more passionate about Nordic skiing, cross-country skiing.
So tell me about how you competed in cross-country skiing and like to what level you got to.
Well, when my dad passed away when I was 20, so I took a semester off from college and moved back home with my mom because I was an only child. So it was just the three of us. And my dad died. He was quite a lot older than my mom. He's 35 years older than my mom.
Wow.
So he died at 78. He was a very youthful man then. The day he died, he went out to the woods and he cut down a tree that was like 2.5 feet in diameter with a bow saw. And cut some limbs off of him, dragged him up to his studio. He was a writer and worked on some stuff, came up and had lunch, went back down and did some more writing. Then he was like cutting up some more wood in the evening before dinner and he had a heart attack and died. So it was just, you know, I spent my whole childhood thinking that he was about to die. Mm-hmm. And then I finally relaxed about it. Like, oh, okay. He's older than my mom, but he's not like he's about to pass away or anything. And then he just suddenly died of a heart attack. So it was really shocking for myself and my mom. So I moved back home with her and, there was really, you know, not a lot to do in the winter in Massachusetts. So I got a job, teaching cross country skiing. I started training 7 days a week. Got this amazing coach from Boston to help me out with some stuff. I gave him cross-country ski lessons, and he wrote up training programs for me, and which involved weight training and skiing. And I guess that year I won the Bay State Games for my age category, which is exciting.
The Bay State Games, is that like Eastern Shore, like regional type competition?
Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Vermont.
Okay.
And yeah, that was an exciting time. That was really fun. I found that I had this great cardio capacity. And
yeah.
And
did you think about taking it to the next level?
You know,
like Olympics or anything like that?
With all this stuff, it was like, no, like this whole winning the Bay State Games was not really actually that big of a deal. When, like, if a lot of the college students had been, you know, the younger guys were like killing me, and there were some older guys who were killing me too, I just happened to be like right in this age pocket where I could win okay. for my age category. And I had a very similar experience with the mountain biking. You know, I found immediate success at it, and then I was really good at it in a local arena. And then you step outside into a slightly bigger arena, and you find the level of competition goes up significantly. Mm-hmm. It's happened to me over and over again in my life. I was really good at ping pong in Marlboro College, where there were 200 people, and then like one of the best three students out of all those 200. And so the three of us, we went to a tournament in Boston and found out that there's a whole other level to the game. And, you know, these guys were sponsored and they had Elise shoes and shirts and, you know, butterfly headbands, and they were just destroyed us.
Nice. Well, what about the road cycling? Because that's one of my passions that I've gotten into the last couple of years.
It's just so much fun. I love it. You know, we have this road biking mecca in up in Marin.
Oh, yeah.
And there's just such fantastic, silky, smooth roads. Back in Massachusetts, there are amazing roads for road cycling, too. I'm talking like some of the most scenic roads that you'll ever ride down. And with the populations in the hundreds in these towns, you don't see very many cars either. So I got super spoiled riding around out there. And there's lots of communities of cyclists. You know, all the bike shops have their rides that they do, and there's races going on all the time during the summer. It was really, really fun part of growing up and being adolescent back there, getting involved in that scene and just riding through the most scenic landscapes you can possibly imagine. And then, you know, the same thing happened to me with the road biking, the mountain biking, and the cross country skiing. So I found that I would work really hard and be really dedicated and eat right and train really hard and go to bed early on Friday night so I could get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and put my bike in the car and go to the race and, you know, check in, get my number, check out the course, wait around for my race to start. Absolutely destroy myself to the point where I could barely drive home and get home at like 8 o'clock at night, be dead dog tired the following day. And that's a whole weekend can revolve around that race. If you want to go as fast and hard as you physically can for 2 hours, it takes a whole weekend. And if you want to be really good at it, it takes months and months and years of preparation beforehand, all for that one moment. And at a certain point, I looked at it and I said, I really love to ride my bike, but, you know, I could get up, drink a coffee, read the paper, go for a nice medium-paced ride, and then go out to dinner with my friends. And, like, there were other ways that I could enjoy riding besides being really competitive with it.
Yeah.
And that
so you were competing in a lot of races.
Yeah. I had a sponsorship from, with the road biking, not so much. I've done quite a few road bike races, but with the mountain biking, I went a little deeper into it. I got a sponsorship from Kona. They make bikes, a Hawaiian company, and the local bike shop sponsored me too, which didn't mean a whole lot. Basically they paid for my end race fees and took care of my bike for me. And Kona gave me a really expensive titanium bicycle, and I would wear some jerseys to wear when I raced. And at the time that I finished, I was ranked 8th in New England, and I had some really disappointing races too. I felt like I should be doing much better. I just was never very good at competing. I'd get out in the front and I would kind of slow down and wait for people to catch me. I was much better at like coming from behind, but
yeah.
you know, it's tricky business. There's always another level to it. And, you know, the farther you go into it, the more dedicated you have to be to keep up.
Right.
Unless you happen to be somebody with just a ridiculous amount of natural talent, which if you're that good, you know, before you're
right
in college.
Yeah. I know what you mean about it wearing you out. When I first started riding, I kept building up to bigger and bigger rides, and I wasn't even going that fast, you know, but I'd eventually be going on these, you know, like 50, 60 mile rides, you know, that would take me, I don't know, five hours or so.
That's a long
distance.
And you're
going up like big climbs. And that's, you know, that's half a day right there if you're getting up in the morning to do that. But then when I'd get back, I'd be so exhausted that I didn't want to do anything. So, I mean, it was like a day, you know, it was like I was dedicating my whole day to a ride. And I similarly like backed down. I'm like, I want to just enjoy like a nice simple ride. And so now I'm more apt to just ride across the bridge, go up Hawk Hill, you know, or do some like 20, 30 mile ride. Where it's like 3 or 4 hours and it's like a part of my day versus the entire day.
And to be honest, that's probably healthier for you. More isn't always better when it comes to exercise.
Right.
You realize why these Tour de France guys have to eat all day long. After you go for a 60 mile ride and do a bunch of climbs, walk into your kitchen and you just eat everything in sight and then collapse and fall down fast asleep on the kitchen floor.
Right. So what, how old were you at this point when you were doing the competitive, like road and mountain bike racing?
That was, college and just after college.
Okay. So I know, you know, we're leading up to this fitness instructor era.
Yeah.
Which I know there's some more stuff in between, you know, before we get there. You had told me that you also were a life coach.
That's
for
right.
For a period of time.
I went back to school for school psychology and I made it through one semester and this guy named Chris Cotton from New Hampshire approached me through a friend of mine. He found out about me, got my number, called me up and I set up an interview with him and I went up to New Hampshire and interviewed for a position as a life coach in his business, helping out these children who had all various problems with the law or with school or with their not being able to get along with their parents and had been sent away to various camps. Like there's all these wilderness camps and they're pretty controversial when you get start to look into them because some of them are pretty brutal and they'll make the kids sleep outside and you know they can get pretty rough. But this one wasn't like that. It was very posh. But these kids really needed some help, and he had this life coaching business, and he was paying me more than I probably would have ever made as a school psychologist at the time. And I couldn't refuse it, and I went up there, and I learned a lot about life coaching from him, went on to like dig a little deeper into it. I went and did a certification with Martha Beck out in Arizona, who's Oprah's life coach and a regular columnist in O Magazine. She's amazing. And I learned her North Star life coach techniques, which served me really well. And part of the reason why I moved out to the West Coast was because I had a life coaching practice on the East Coast. And there was always the hump of getting over, like, what is a life coach? What do you do? How do you help me? Like, nobody really understood exactly how it worked because it's like a very, very young and burgeoning profession. And that's a big thing to get over if you're trying to market yourself and sell something. Now I say I'm a personal trainer and people immediately have this whole idea of how it works. Yeah. They're going to pay me some money. I'm going to make them feel better, get them in better shape. And that's pretty much all there is to it. So the life coaching can mean a lot of different things.
Yeah. But so, I mean, you started with these kids at these camps, but then did you expand that business into other people?
I did. Yeah. I did. Yeah. I had, you know, various like small time marketing efforts that I made back on the East Coast, and they resulted in clients. And I had clients who I met with in person, and I had clients who I met with on the phone. And I continued that when I came out here to San Francisco. Had about 6 clients at one point here in San Francisco who I was meeting with on a regular basis.
So can you think of anybody you really helped out?
No. No, I'm just kidding. It was remarkable. Like, everybody who I worked with experienced transformation. And through watching them go through all these different things that they were doing in their lives, that, like, I felt like I was growing through them, and like they were giving me courage. And, you know, it's when somebody hires a life coach, they, you know, if you want to talk about your feelings, you go to a therapist. And if you want to, like, accomplish something that you're not able to do on your own, then you go to a life coach. And a good life coach will take where you are and where you want to be and help you fill in the spaces in between with little tiny turtle steps. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing, no big scary leaps. You just nice, safe, easy little steps that are manageable. And before you know it, you've bridged the gap.
Yeah. Can you give me an example of somebody?
It ranged everything from people coming out of the closet to switching jobs to getting out of relationships that they didn't want to be in, to getting into relationships they didn't want to be in, to getting into relationships they wanted to be in, I mean. And, you know, people sometimes moved also. I'd start talking to them and I'd say, what does your ideal day look like? Oh, my ideal day, I'd wake up and I'd go for a swim in the ocean and have a nice walk on the beach. And I would have all kinds of stuff that really isn't possible in San Francisco. My first thing, I'd be like, why are you living here? And they would just say, that's interesting. And so some people like moved to tropical locations. And, all kinds of stuff. My very first life coach client really, you know, came to me with one thing in mind. And then it came out as we started talking that really what he wanted to do was be comfortable to come out as a gay man. And that was, to see him go through that process and become comfortable with that was probably one of the most gratifying things. It really got me hooked into it. And I thought, wow, this is great. I can really affect people's lives in a positive way.
What made you get out of life coaching? It sounds like things were going pretty well for you. You're in San Francisco. You have these clients. You're helping them transform their lives. What made you make a transition?
You know, I probably should have been doing physical training from the time I was entered college, but I always would think it and then dismiss it because I just never identified myself as somebody who would be a personal trainer. I had all kinds of stereotypes in my head about who this personal trainer person is. And yeah, they got the big
dudes.
Muscles and, you know, the perfect skin and they're like standing there, you know, telling you what to do in a forceful voice. And that's not really my training style. So it took me a while to come around to it, but my friend Arlo, who I've known since I was 2, he just said to me at one point, hey, why don't you just get paid to do what you love to do? I've always been wanting, even when I was life coaching these kids, a lot of that would be like, hey, let's go to the gym. Let's go for a run. Let's go for a hike. I was always trying to get them to be more active because I knew that made them feel better and it would improve everything else in their life. So, and when I finally came around to it, I thought, well, okay, I'll see if I can get pass this test and get certified as a trainer. And that may be fun to do some personal training with people, or at least just from my own personal knowledge. I didn't even really take it very seriously when I was setting out to do it. And I got the materials for the exam and I was expected to spend about 6 months studying them and to get ready for the test. And I was like, looked at them and I was like, hey, I already know all of this. I've been studying this stuff my whole life. And I just kind of looked it over, sat down for the test, passed the test, and wow, now I have a certification. And my girlfriend at the time was a graphic designer. She made up some cards for me. And I wrote a little personal letter. I went down and applied for a job at Stanford University.
Okay.
Started training down there. And it didn't
so that was your first gig?
That was my first gig. Okay. It was at Stanford. And then while I was at Stanford, I thought, I'm going to make some extra. I was working there during the week, training in the faculty and staff out of their gym. And then I thought, you know, I'll get some clients on the weekend too. So I wrote a little letter and pinned my business card to it and went and knocked on every door on my block over in Noe Valley. And I had, at the end of 1 hour, I had like 8 clients signed up.
Man, so, what does letter say?
It said, hey, you know, it was really funny because it just basically said, I'm your neighbor and I'm a personal trainer. And if you want to work out with me, I'll work you out right here in the neighborhood for $35 an hour as an introductory rate. Mm-hmm. And of course they thought, wow, that's a really good deal.
Yeah.
But the thing that was interesting was I'd knock on the door and the door would, you know, sometimes not even open. Who is it? And I would say, hi, it's your neighbor, Lark. And they'd hear neighbor and shink, the door would just fly right open. Mm. And, you know, I think if I'd tried to go to some other neighborhood and do it without the neighbor thing, it wouldn't have worked at all.
Right.
But the fact that when you live in the city, you maybe have hundreds of neighbors.
Yeah.
You know, maybe 1,000 people you could call your neighbor. And
so that started the one-on-one coaching for that the first started time.
I would just work my way right up and down the street. And I had, you know, working people out on the sidewalks, on the sidewalk in front of their house.
Wow. Like what type of workouts were you doing? Like push-ups and things like that? Sprints down the, the road?
Sprinting up and down the roads, squats, lunges, planks. I set up the TRX. It's like a suspension training thing, you know, just pulling exercises on that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, have a little tiny bit of equipment I'd carry, have some bands and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You really don't need a lot of equipment to get in great shape.
So then how did you transition that into Infinite Fitness, right? Which is the fitness company that you founded,
mm-hmm.
right? And now that that's where you spend all your time, right?
Yeah. So at the time that I started training people in Noe Valley on the street, I also figured out that, you know, it dawned on me that there's so many people here in the city who want a trainer and who want to work out with a trainer that I don't really need to be driving down to Stanford 5 days a week. As cool as it was down there and as much as I liked saying that I worked at Stanford, and it was wonderful there. They took really good care of me. I learned a lot. But I, you know, went and applied at Club One and got a job there. And I was by far the youngest trainer, and all bunch of trainers there had a lot of experience. They took me under their wing, and you know, I would just devour everything they've given me. DVDs, books, magazines, you know, watching the workouts that they do with their clients, asking lots of questions. So I felt like I was growing very fast with a lot of good guidance from experienced trainers there.
Okay.
And then it was about a year, and I thought to myself, you know, I don't need to be, you know, my clients are paying $85 an hour to work out with me, and I'm getting $35 an hour. There's a lot of money that I'm making for Club One here. And if I'm training 25 or 30 hours a week, and I didn't like that aspect of it too much. So I started looking for other places I could open my own facility. And I had met my client, Chris Bentley, and I was training him and his wife at the time. And you know, I asked him, hey, do you have any space in your building? He owns a Bentley Reserve right there in the middle of the financial district.
Right.
And he was immediately said, hey, come on over. Let's look at some spaces. We'd love to have you in the building. And it was, you know, all very easy and just happened to fall into the right circumstance of having a client and a friend who wanted to help me out, who had real estate right there in the financial district.
And what year was this that you started?
That That was, let's see, I'm not very good with time. Time seems to float by out here in San Francisco, and I can't, hard to keep track of the years as they tick by. But I guess that was about, let's see, it was 2005, 2006.
Okay. So when I was researching you,
yeah,
before this interview, I Googled you.
Okay.
And I'm kind of looking down the first page, but it's a normal stuff, you know, your website, your LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm.
But then I came across this article from SF Racked, and you were nominated in 2013 as one of San Francisco's hottest trainers.
That was funny.
One of so somebody out there thought you were pretty sexy.
Probably my girlfriend. I think she's the only one.
Tell me about this competition. I mean, did you win?
No, I lost really badly.
You lost really badly. Yeah. Okay.
But
you were nominated.
I was nominated, and they came and took some pictures, and you know, I saw some of the other trainers who I was up against, and they were,
are these, you know, pictures of you just like flexing a jock strap or something like that?
No. I left my shirt on. A lot of people did not.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That's why I didn't win, man.
Well, no, it's really just pretty much popularity contest.
Okay.
You know, the trainers who have the big classes and have a high volume of clients and told everybody, all of them, to vote for them, I think got a lot of votes. And the ones who have a smaller clientele and maybe didn't market themselves as hard didn't get as many votes.
Okay.
So I think that was pretty much what that contest was about. I don't think there's any real credence behind any one of those people being like the hottest trainer. That's, you know, as I say, it's beauty is in the eye of the buttholder.
Never heard that one before. I like that.
One of my clients told me that. He came up with it on the spot. I thought it was hilarious.
So you're a fitness instructor in San Francisco. And I feel like San Franciscans in general are already like very healthy people. They're
absolutely
doing a lot of things right. A lot of things right. But how can we, what are some things we can do to be even healthier?
Well, I agree with you. San Franciscans are very healthy, and there's lots of healthy options for eating. Lots of people exercise a lot. People, you know, mental health too. People do yoga and meditate and talk about their feelings. And that's, you know, people do spend a lot of time taking really good care of themselves. I think it's a really progressive area in that way. Now, the one thing that I think that San Franciscans could do a better job with that's really simple is just get out in the sun a little bit more without their clothes on. Butt naked would be the best, but, you know, there are some laws against that. From what I understand, there's been quite a battle going on down at
that's true.
City Hall. And I think that it's come down to everybody can go topless, but nobody can go bottomless. I'm not sure how that law sits right now, actually.
Right. Well, I'm comfortable with that.
At one point, you were allowed to be naked, but you just couldn't sit on the public transportation seat or a public bench or something like that.
Okay.
There's been a bunch of different laws about it. It's pretty funny stuff, really.
Right.
I've seen them, you know, crowds of naked people rallying down there.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty small crowds, you know, not in the hundreds. That's funny stuff. But really what I'm talking about is getting, very simply, getting most of your body in the sun for 5 to 10 minutes a day, and you will not be vitamin D deficient. And best thing to do is between 11 a.m. and 2 p.m., get out in the sun, take your shirt off, you know, have some, get out in there in your shorts. And I'm not talking about a lot of sun or a long time, just a little bit of sun. And the moment your skin starts to turn pink, your body's making vitamin D. And that's how we make vitamin D. It's the only vitamin that's not present in breast milk.
Hmm.
And that gives us a clue about how it's supposed to be absorbed. Not from our diet.
Right.
People, I don't think that people really understand that. And even doctors will prescribe people take, you know, massive quantities of vitamin D on a daily basis or megadose on their vitamin D. And then your body still only absorbs a little tiny bit of it. And it's cold and it's blustery here. And That's pretty much the only part of California that's not sunny and hot. And I think that we suffer a little bit because of that.
What happens when people don't get enough vitamin D? I know you're not a doctor.
Oh, well, there is a whole list of maladies. I mean, that your chances of getting a whole, I mean, there's probably a list like 2 pages long of all the diseases, and cancer rates go up, and it's pretty grim, really. It's a real problem. It's a national epidemic. But I think here in San Francisco, it might even be worse than some other areas. And
so
you can't absorb enough through your face and your hands. It's just right. Not, or your arms and legs. It's not enough surface area of your body.
So tell me about your strategy then. So you're saying between 11 and 2 every day, you know, it'd be great to just take your shirt off, go out and get some sun. I mean, so if I go down to the building where you teach fitness, and I'm just kind of walking around the neighborhood, is it likely I'm just going to see you out walking around without a shirt? How do you do it?
No, I mostly just lay down in a park or something on the grass. I grab a towel from the gym and I walk out to the park next to the Embarcadero Centers, and I take off my shirt and I lay down there on the grass. And I notice, like, it's a little uncomfortable. People are walking around in suits and stuff, but I suck it up. I feel like it makes me healthier, and I think it makes my skin look not quite so pasty too.
Well, maybe this is how you got noticed for that hottest SF trainer
that
competition a few years back.
That might have been it. I think it was one of my clients, though. I think they might not have put in that recommendation if they'd seen me laying out there in the park without my shirt on.
What about, you know, in San Francisco, you know, like I said, people here are pretty healthy. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of temptations for us as well to be unhealthy, right? I mean, there's a lot of people are foodies here. There's all these great restaurants to go to. You know, there's wine country. There's all this wine that we want to drink. There's all these fun parties to go to. How can people balance both of those? You know, how can you have maximum health, but then have some fun? I want to have a little bit of fun too, Lark, you know?
Yeah. One thing that really helps is, you know, you got to just pick your battles.
Yeah.
Where are you going to be good? Like, hopefully you can develop some really healthy eating habits at home and during the week, so that when you want to go out to eat or you want to go to a party and have a bunch of drinks on the weekend, you can blow it a little bit here and there and get away with it.
Right.
Now, if you're blowing it every morning when you wake up with your breakfast, and then you're eating a poor lunch, and then you're going out for a big dinner, and you're going out partying and drinking on the weekends, that's not gonna look too good on you after a while.
How many cheat meals can I have a week?
You know,
what do you think?
I usually go with like 5 or 6.
5 or 6 cheat?
Cheat meals.
I like that.
You know, usually the way I think about it in general is I'm pretty good during the week. Hmm. And then I pretty much blow it on the weekends and manage to maintain a pretty healthy weight. It's tricky in the city. You know, there is a lot of temptation, and dining out, you can never really eat super healthy eating out.
It is easier here in San Francisco versus like eating out in other places. I have found that.
There are places that you can go and eat quite healthy eating out. But even then, you know, there are very few and far between where you're actually going to be eating organic food 100%. And, you know, I mean, eating healthy is pretty much, if you want to say I'm really, really being healthy, what are you eating? You're eating almost exclusively vegetables, and you get some fruits in there and some form of protein, hopefully, ideally, beans, nuts, seeds, but...
So no meats?
No, I mean, it's always going to be healthier to be vegetarian. And, you know, and this comes back to it depends too, because some people try to eat a vegetarian diet and they have low energy and they feel terrible on it, and they eat a meat-based diet and they feel much better. So I know some people analyze this stuff through blood type and stuff, but, with diet, and even more, perhaps even more than with exercise, it is truly a matter of experimentation. And you have to experiment on your body and be aware of how different foods are making you feel.
Right.
And some, it doesn't even really take that long. People say, you know, go 3 weeks without eating dairy, wheat, sugar, caffeine, and then try introducing those things one at a time for a week and see how you feel. I don't think it really takes that long. I think you can go 3 days without eating any of that stuff and then eat a bunch of it, and you'll know pretty fast how it makes you feel. And I've done that before, and found out that dairy makes me a little bit sniffly. Sugar.
Sniffly, like?
Like, yeah, just like I have some kind of dairy allergy.
Interesting.
Yeah, get like a little allergic reaction to it where I just get a little sniffly. Like almost if I don't eat dairy for a while and then I eat like a bowl of ice cream, the next day like my nose will be running like I have a cold. But it only lasts one day, and I'll have great energy, and I won't be like contagious or actually have a cold. It's just a little allergy.
Okay.
And, you know, sugar kind of makes my skin look a little red and inflamed, and wheat kind of makes my stomach puff out a little bit. And none of this stuff is extreme enough to make me not eat it. But it's I know that all these things are in some way aren't the healthiest and best things for me to eat. And vegetables, you will have a hard time finding somebody with a vegetable allergy.
Right. So let's talk about San Francisco and some of your favorite spots. I want to start with your neighborhood. What neighborhood do you live in?
Dolores and Market.
Dolores and Market. So is that, would you consider that DeBose Park or the Mission, or it's right there on the border?
You know, I think it's probably Dolores Market. Honestly, I think it's the Mission technically.
Yeah.
I think.
Just the very start of the Mission, right?
Yeah. Like the very edge of the Mission. There's probably some technical name for it that has to do with Market Street.
Is it right there by like Churchill, that bar Churchill?
You know, it's about a block and a half from Churchill.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that would be, I guess it's DeBose Triangle.
Yeah. Did I say DeBose Park? I meant DeBose Triangle.
DeBose Triangle.
DeBose Triangle in the Mission.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I haven't lived there for very long, but it's a pretty cool neighborhood.
Yeah. So tell me about that neighborhood, and I want to know what your three favorite things to do or places to go are in that neighborhood.
My number one favorite place to go in that neighborhood has to be Byright.
Byright, yeah.
It's like
right by Dolores Park.
Right by Dolores Park. Go down to Byright. They have all kinds of the freshest berries and like artisan cheeses and great wines that you can buy. And I've got to warn you, it's not cheap in there. If you think Whole Foods is expensive, don't go to Byright because it's all specialty items, but you can buy a bottle of whiskey. You know, they've got booze behind the counter, and you can put together. The best thing to get there is the tuna niçoise sandwich.
Okay.
And like the insider thing that the.
It's from their deli or what?
From their deli. Okay. Order the tuna niçoise from the sandwich from the deli and ask them to put some fried onions on it. Grab a bottle of wine. Dolores Park is right around the corner. You can go sit in the sun and people watch. It's one of the best places to people watch. You got this beautiful green lawns and palm trees, and then that super, super view of downtown San Francisco over the top of the park.
Right.
And that school that's there, Mission High, is really cool, beautiful looking structure too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What else?
I like Zuni Cafe.
Yep. It's just love that place.
It's been around for so long, and breakfast, lunch, dinner, I'll eat there anytime. They have one of the best burgers in the city, which you can only get at certain times of day. It's like a late night thing, I think, after a certain hour at night. I'm never quite sure exactly when you can and can't get it, but it's delicious. Got the little shoestring French fries. This goes on our cheat meal.
Yeah.
Balsamic Bloody Marys.
Nice.
Incredible. Yeah. And it's also just about, you know, all those windows, so much light in there.
Yeah, it's a very unique building because it's like triangular, right?
Yeah.
One of those corners that are kind of triangular.
Yeah, and right where that triangle is, that's all the bar seating.
Yeah.
So you don't need a reservation or anything. You can just roll in and sit right down in one of those
nice
big glass windows.
Outside seating as well.
Exactly.
The cafe seating on the outside. I love that place. Okay.
Yeah, it's a real gem.
I don't know if I want to call it a tradition, but one of the things I've started doing is on Friday mornings, to kind of replace a workout, I just get up early on Friday and I walk to, Tartine Bakery.
Ooh.
So, I mean, I walk right by where you live, right? Yeah. I mean, it's 3 mile walk from here, you know, so it's a nice 45 minutes to an hour.
That's great.
But I get in line early and I get the morning bun, which I love. I had lived in San Francisco for over 6 years before I had my first one, and I finally went over there and I loved it. And so now I just love walking over there in the morning, and then I'll come back a little bit, go around the corner to Cafe Stanza. Mm. Do you know where that is?
No, what is Cafe Stanza?
It's right across the street from Monk's Kettle. So what is that, 16th and Guerrero? Maybe something like that, but it's just a really cool like coffee shop.
Oh, right.
And so I'll get a coffee there and I'll like work there in the morning and then maybe like get lunch in the Mission somewhere. But I love walking through that DuBose Triangle area and like that area around Market Street right there. I think it's really cool.
San Francisco is like a treasure chest, and you just keep digging around, you're gonna find so many jewels. And just when you think you got this place figured out, there's 100 new restaurants opened up and 300 new coffee shops and little clothing shops with some handmade thing you'd never seen or heard of. And
right. So you've been in San Francisco for how long now?
Almost a decade here.
Almost a decade.
Yeah.
You pretty happy here?
You know, I love it here. I feel very much at home here. And as far as the cities go, this is the coolest city I've ever been in. I love New York, and Paris is awesome. There's every city has its fun, neat things about it, but San Francisco just has such a nice warmth and friendliness and openness to the people, and so much creativity in the food and all the things that you can do around the city. It's really captured my heart. I love San Francisco.
I agree with you. No place I'd rather live. So then let me ask you a tough question. Let's say you had to move away.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, hey, man, the look you just made was like absolute fear. Well, let's say for whatever reason you had to move away from San Francisco.
And a lot of people do.
They do.
Because they can't afford it.
Right. How would you spend your last day in San Francisco before you left?
That's a good question. You know, I think that I would have to at least go up to Twin Peaks and sit up on top of that hill and look down at the city.
Yep.
And just take it all in once. Probably have to drink a couple balsamic Bloody Marys at Zuni. You know, if it was a Sunday, one of my favorite things to do in the whole city is go and walk around Golden Gate Park on a Sunday. And there's no traffic allowed in. And the feeling that comes out of that is very utopian. And it's pretty magical in there on Sundays. You got all these rollerbladers, people taking dance classes, and it's just so quiet and peaceful without the cars. And I would like to actually see more of that in San Francisco. There's just so many cars in this city and every city. You take away the cars and the... Here I got on my soapbox. I'm supposed to be talking about my last day,
okay.
But...
That's okay. That's one of the things I love about living here is the walkability that I don't have to drive.
Yeah.
I'm so much happier when I'm not driving around.
Yeah. That is one thing that I would not do if I only had one day here in San Francisco.
Drive somewhere?
Get into a car, yeah.
Try to find parking and somewhere. Yeah, that doesn't sound like a good day.
If you think the traffic is bad during the week, it gets worse on the weekends.
Right. Okay, so you're walking around Golden Gate Park enjoying that. Then what do you do?
After Golden Gate Park?
After Golden Gate Park.
Then I'm probably strolling right across the city over to Boulevard or Gary Danko, one or the other, and get a steak.
Have your last dinner there.
Have my last dinner there. And some fine cocktails, steak, and some fancy dessert that I have no idea what it is, but it melts on my tongue.
I like that. Sounds like a hell of a day. As I thought back on Lark's story, it reminded me of myself a little bit. Both Lark and I, we grew up in a place that was a lot different and very far away from San Francisco, but our journeys eventually led us here, and now we love it, and there's no place on earth we'd rather live than right here in San Francisco. So I really liked that commonality as I reflected on our Lark's story there. So if you're interested in getting a fitness session with Lark, go to his website. It's coachlark.com. You can find all of his contact info there and set something up with him downtown, maybe right after work one day. If you want to read even more about Lark, you can go to the San Francisco People website at sfpeoplepodcast.com. From the front page, just click on Lark's picture, and you can get links to everything we talked about, including all of his favorite places that he mentioned in the DuBose Triangle and throughout San Francisco. You can also follow the show on Twitter at SF People Podcast. And if you have any guests in mind for a future episode of San Francisco People, send them my way. I'd love to hear about them and maybe invite them on the show. So you can tag them with the hashtag SF People on Twitter, or you can email me at frank@sfpeoplepodcast.com. Thanks again to everybody for listening. We'll be back in a few weeks. I'm Frank Garza for San Francisco People.